For the past little bit, we've been in a series called 90 Days with Jesus. And what we've been doing is we've been going through the biographies of Jesus's life in the Bible. And so here's how this talk today came about. I was reading through the Bible a couple months ago, and there was a word that like popped off the page. And when I saw this word, I realized, okay, I think this is a massive weak point in my own relationship with God. And also, I don't think I know how to define this word. I've seen it 20 million times, and I don't know that I even know what it means. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, so a later part in the Bible, the Apostle Paul says, listen, in all of your relationship with God, there are three components that are the most important. And if you're missing any one of these three components, your relationship with God is gonna fall apart. I know a lot of us aren't religious. You're like maybe skeptical of Christianity, checking it out. And honestly, these are the three components of life. If you're missing any of these, you're gonna not live a very satisfying life. And the first word is a word we talk about all the time. It's the word faith. And so I'm like, okay, I think I understand that. The last word is the word we talk about the most, which is the word love. I'm like, okay, I think I got that. But then there's a middle word that bridges the two. And that's the word hope. And here's what's really fascinating. Here's what the Bible says about hope. To lack hope is to lack emotional and spiritual maturity. To lack hope is to lack emotional and spiritual maturity. Here's the full quote that Paul gives in its context. Paul says, when I was a child, I spoke and thought and reasoned like a child. But when I grew up, when I stopped being a baby, I put childish things away. For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror, but one day we're gonna see face to face. Now I know things in part, but one day I will know fully, even as I am fully known. But now these three remain the most important things, faith, hope, and love. And Paul will make the case that love is the greatest even of those three, but you're not going to be able to get to love without hope. Without hope, you're going to be deeply emotionally immature and deeply spiritually immature. But here's what makes this, I think, pretty complicated. So the English word hope, in my opinion, might be the most annoying word that we have in our entire dictionary. It's a word that basically means nothing. I looked up hope in just Google image and found the following photos. So here's the first one. So this Hallmark movie, Hope at Christmas. Does anyone watch Hallmark movies in this? Okay, you're part of the problem. I'm always like, who is watching this? Anyway, but everything's like so cheesy. So it's like, okay, hope is the only bee that makes honey without flowers. I could not tell you what that means. Hope. I guess that one's actually rope. So my mother-in-law is the most innocent person I've ever met to a fault. She thinks the word crap is a swear word, just for context here. And she has at her house these freestanding letters in her window that she got from like Hobby Lobby, where it spells out faith, hope, and love. And my favorite thing to do at my mother-in-law's house is to hide the P from the word hope. Oh, Josiah, what an awful word, you know? Anyways, but like in our culture, hope just means like naive optimism. It just means wishful thinking. And think about like how insincerely we use the word hope. We'll say, I hope you feel better. They're not gonna feel better. I hope that works out for you. I don't think it's gonna work out for you. And so with that, I started doing a deep dive in the Bible. I'm like, there's no way that that's what the Bible means by the word hope. And I found two things that were really interesting. First of all, the New Testament alone uses the word hope 80 times. So this is a behemoth theme in the Bible. But second, every time they use the word hope, it's always attached to something concrete that they are absolutely confident is going to happen. There's no like, I don't know if it's gonna work out or not. The Greek word that we translate into the English word hope comes from this Greek word right here, elpizo. But here's the biblical concept of hope. Here's what it means. Choosing to bridge the gap between what's true about my current situation and what's true about God. Hope is choosing, it's a choice. Choosing to bridge the gap between what's true about my current situation and what's true about God. Now, let me explain what I mean by this. So if you're a person in this room and you would say that you're religious or you believe in God, there's probably certain things that you would say out here, I believe is true about God. So you would probably say, I believe Jesus can do anything. He can do whatever miracle. You would probably say, I believe Jesus is completely loving no matter what. Like, you're nodding your head to this. You would probably say, we talked about last week, I believe that one day Jesus is gonna come back and he's gonna fix everything that's wrong in the world, and that day is gonna be incredible. So there's these like religious ethereal truths that you claim to believe. But then there's your present circumstance and the situations that you're actually in. And these are things like, I mean, like the stupidest things. I mean, something like this. I am currently sitting in a 2-hour meeting about nothing on Zoom. And that's how I spent my day today. It's things like, I'm going to have a conversation with someone who's upset with me, and they're gonna freak out, and then I'm probably gonna freak out, and we're not gonna budge, nothing's gonna change. It's the trivial all the way to the very serious. I just had a family member that passed away. I just received news that absolutely destroyed my life. From the trivial all the way to the most devastating, there's the current situation that I'm actually standing in. Here's what's true about most Christians and most religious people. For the vast majority of the world, these two sets of truths are completely disconnected. Yeah, I believe these things about God, but this thing, there's nothing bridging these two things together. They don't affect each other. What hope is hope is a bridge between these two realities. Hope is saying, yes, I am standing in this circumstance, but I'm choosing to reach over and to hold on to these truths that I concretely believe about God and live as if these things are true in my present circumstance, no matter how mundane it is. Now, here's what's really interesting, okay? If I cannot bridge what I claim to believe to my present circumstance, I functionally have no belief in God. If I can't grab onto these truths and live them out in real time from the trivial to the most horrible, if I can't do that, you might as well not have a relationship with God at all, because your belief basically has no function. And there's a story in the Bible that I think unpacks this better than any other story. It's in the book of John where we've been. So we're gonna be in the book of John, chapter 6. It starts in verse 1. I'll have it on the screens right here. Here's what it says. Jesus crossed over to the far side of the Sea of Galilee, also known as the Sea of Tiberias. And when he did this, a huge crowd kept following Jesus wherever he went because they saw his miraculous signs and he healed the sick. Then Jesus climbed a hill. He sat down with his disciples around him. It was nearly time for the Jewish Passover celebration, and Jesus soon saw a huge crowd of people coming to look for him. So Jesus had 12 disciples. They're like his inner circle that were his closest friends. And so what happened is Jesus and his 12 disciples were trying to like escape the crowds and escape like basically the fame. And so they go and find a spot basically to have like a Bible study, have a picnic, that kind of thing, to rest, to escape. And when Jesus gets to this place to escape, what happens is a crowd forms around him. Now we find out later that the crowd is 5,000 men. They used to only count like the governmental head of households back in the day. So it's 5,000 men. Scholars would tell us it's between 15 and 20,000 people if you count women and children. Just for context, that is the size of Rocket Arena, the Cavs Arena. So Jesus and his disciples are trying to escape the crowds, and 20,000 people come and circle around him trying to learn from him. So Jesus turns to one of his disciples, his friend, Philip, and here's what he says to Philip. He says, hey, Philip, where can we buy bread to feed all these people? And when he asked this question, he was testing Philip, keyword testing. He was testing Philip, for he already knew what he was gonna do. Jesus turns to Philip and asks him a question for the pure sake of stressing him out. Philip, hey, do you think like Aldi sells enough bread? You know, hey, Philip, do you think we have the money to feed 20,000 people? Where can we? And he was testing him. Now, the word test in the Bible literally means to measure the quality of something. So I want you to track this. Jesus is looking at Philip and saying, I want to measure the quality of our relationship. I want to measure the quality of the faith that you have. But the way I'm gonna measure the quality of your faith is not by giving you a theology exam, and it's not by playing an emotional worship song and see if you cry and raise your hands. The way I'm going to measure the quality of your belief is by putting you in a mildly overwhelming and inconvenient situation. Why? What's the point? Everybody track with me on something. The amount of hope you have in mildly overwhelming and inconvenient situations shows the amount of trust you have in Jesus altogether. The best indicator of where you're at with God is probably not anything you do at church. It's probably not anything you know about the Bible. It probably has nothing to do with that. The best indicator of your relationship with God is how you like function when you're stuck in traffic or when someone does something annoying or offensive or even harmful. And what I wanna do today is I wanna show you 5 signs that the bridge from my current situation to the things I claim to believe about God has collapsed. 5 signs that I don't have hope, and essentially my relationship with God has no function. It's like useless. And then we're gonna talk about how to restore that bridge. Here's the first symptom that I have no hope. It's my immediate emotional reaction to being overwhelmed. The first symptom indicator that I have no hope is my immediate emotional reaction to being overwhelmed. Look at Philip's reaction to Jesus. Jesus asked, Philip, where can we buy bread for all these people? Philip replied, Jesus, you can't be serious. Even if we worked for months, we would spend all our money. We would never have enough time. Even if we worked for months, we wouldn't have enough money to feed them. Philip is not going, according to my calculation. Philip is going, you cannot be serious what you're asking right now. I can't even with this right now. You cannot be serious. Now, listen. People tend to think that the number one contributor to your mood or your emotional state or your happiness in life is your current circumstances in the present. So if you have a job that absolutely sucks, you'll say, well, that's the reason I come home grumpy. Or if your family is malfunctioning right now, you'll say, that's the reason I haven't had a ton of patience lately. That's the reason I've been on edge. And what we tend to believe is that the reason I feel this way is because of my circumstance. But if my job were to change or my family were to get it together or whatever it is, then I would feel better. Then I would react very differently. And listen, it is true that your present circumstances are a contributing factor to the way that you behave. But listen, it is not the main factor. In fact, it is far from the main factor. And it is a huge myth to believe that if somehow that situation were to change, you would change in the process as well. There's a great scholar and thinker, a guy named Tim Keller. I quote from him all the time. But he has this great quote where he says, "The way how you live now is completely determined by your believed in future." The way that you respond, the way that you feel, your outlook on life, how you live now is completely determined by what you believe will happen to you in the future. In other words, it's completely determined by your hope. And I can prove this to you for anybody that's skeptical. Keller gives a great example of this. If I were to find 2 people and give them the exact same boring, mundane, awful job for 1 year, my brother Micah, to pay his way through college, he worked at an Amazon warehouse, and here was his job in the Amazon warehouse. His job was to watch a conveyor belt for 8 hours a day, sometimes 10 hours a day. His job was to watch a conveyor belt, and if any box came along that was marked with the letter H, his job was to pick up that box and to put it on another conveyor belt that was labeled H. And he did that for 8 to 10 hours a day. He said one time he was doing his job, and his manager came up to him and said, "Wow, Micah, you are really good at this." Yeah. So I want you to imagine that we find 2 people, we give them that same job, 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, and they have to work that for a year. Same exact circumstance, but here's the only difference. The first guy, I look at the first guy and say, "Hey, if you work at this job for a year, at the end of the year, we will pay you $15,000. Ooh, but the second guy, I look at the second guy and say, "Hey, work at this job for a year, and at the end of that year, I will pay you $150 million. Same circumstance, different outcome. What's the difference? The first guy is gonna come in late every day, and he's gonna be grumpy, and he's gonna complain to his coworkers, and he's gonna quit before the year is over. The second guy is gonna come in early, and he's gonna work as hard as he can, and he's gonna whistle while he works, and he's gonna always talk about what an incredible, great opportunity that I have been given." Why? What's the only difference? The second guy expects something in the future that is dramatically impacting the way that he's interacting with this present. Now listen, if you are believing God to any degree, Jesus gives you a promise that is far more substantial than $150 million. Jesus promises that he will personally cause every detail of your life to work for your good if you trust in him. One of my favorite verses in the Bible is Romans chapter 8 says this: "We know that God works all things from the smallest, most trivial detail, like a wasted minute, all the way to the most painful things that happen. God works all things together for the good of those who love God and who are called according to his purpose for them. This means every diagnosis, every mistake, every broken relationship, every hour that you spent doing nothing, every detail of your life, if you trust in Jesus, God will cause all of those things, every second, to work together for the best possible, most satisfying, fulfilling outcome that you get to live in for all eternity. This also means Jesus will personally undo every tear you've ever cried and flip it so that no matter what degree of sadness you've experienced on earth, you'll experience 10x that in happiness in heaven for the rest of eternity with him. And Jesus is so dead set on doing this for you that he has said, I will literally die before I let that promise go unfulfilled. I will die before I let any detail of your life be wasted. And of course, if you know the story, Jesus ultimately does die, resurrects from the dead, getting rid of any obstacle that would prevent him from doing that. And that's the hope that I get to live in every day. Now, if you believe that at all, here's what that means. Can I suggest something to you? Can I suggest that the reason you feel defeated or you keep snapping at people or you're empty or anxious or feel angry or feel unhappy is not because you're underappreciated or because you're single or because you're broke or because your job sucks or because you're in the quote unquote wrong phase of life. The reason you are like this is because you don't really believe the thing that's promised to you. You don't really believe that Jesus is gonna do the things that he promised that he was gonna do for you. And you might say, well, Josiah, I believe the Bible. Yeah, you believe the Bible in your head, but you don't believe it with your emotions. And you definitely don't believe it with your initial reactions. And Jesus would say, your emotions and your reactions are a far greater indicator of what you actually believe than the things that you say. Listen, if you can't live for God in the micro moments of your life, it's because you don't actually trust him in the deepest parts of your heart. If you can't live for God, I'm talking about the gas station, bro. If you can't live for God in the micro moments of your life, it's because you don't actually trust him in the deepest parts of your heart, which leads to symptom number two. Symptom number two that the bridge of hope, that I'm not actually having a functional faith, has collapsed. The symptom number two is avoidance. Let's continue in the story. Watch what the disciples do. The book of Mark gives us some extra details. Late in the afternoon, the disciples came to Jesus and said, hey, Jesus, this is a remote place. We're finally all by ourselves. It's getting late, so will you please send the crowds away so that they can go to the nearby farms and villages and buy something to eat? Can we please have our time to recharge together? Send the crowds away. But Jesus looks and says, no, I don't wanna do that. You feed them. No, I don't wanna do that. You feed them. Symptom number two is avoidance, and here's why. One of the clearest indicators that I have no hope is I secretly and subconsciously avoid any situation where God might actually ask me to do something that actually requires me to depend on him. So here's what I mean. I avoid any situation that's too draining. Or I avoid people that are toxic because you don't know how horrible they are for my mental health. My mom is crazy. I avoid any scenario that brings me like kind of to the edge of my limits because I'm afraid I'm gonna snap or I'm afraid I'm gonna spiral. I avoid any scenario that costs me too much. So it messes with my schedule because I gotta go to bed at 9 o'clock because I gotta wake up at 5. It costs me too much money. It costs me too much mental space. I avoid anything, any situation where Jesus is actually going to be required. You understand what I'm saying? But in our culture, we actually have a magic word that we use. And this is the word that we use to justify all of this behavior and convince ourselves that this is actually good for us and this is actually healthy behavior. And it's this word right here, boundaries. Boundaries. Now, before anyone gets offended, my therapist told me that I need to set boundaries. Before anyone gets offended, let me first say that boundaries can be and often are an incredibly good thing. I have boundaries in my life. I go, no matter how crazy of a work day I have, I go to home at 5:30 so that I can prioritize the people that God has entrusted me, my wife and kids. I say no to most opportunities because I feel that God has called me here and I want to prioritize the things that God has called me to. But everybody listen to me. The reason I have boundaries is to say yes to God, not to say no to him. The reason I have boundaries is to say yes to God, not to say no to him. See, here's what a lot of us have done. Here's what happens. A lot of us have been very burnt out in the past. Maybe you've been in a scenario where, I don't know, you overextended yourself or someone else was taking advantage of your willingness or your enthusiasm or your giftings or whatever it was. And somewhere along the way, you read a book or listened to a podcast and talked to a friend that said, what you need to do is you need to set boundaries in your life. So you set like a really strict schedule and you started limiting the amount of time you are with certain people. Some of us have even boundaries at the church. You're like, I will only serve twice a month. And if you ask more for that, you know, you set up all these boundaries, but here's the problem. Here's the problem. You use your boundaries now to say no to precisely the situations that God has custom designed for you. Now you use your boundaries to look Jesus in the eyes and say, you don't know what's healthy for me. I know what's healthy for me. No, I will not do that. I will not overextend myself. Listen, what is this story? What's happening in this story? Jesus' disciples are using spiritual language and even the language of self-care to look God in the eyes and say no. They're saying, Jesus, we're finally by ourselves. It's time to rest and recharge. Send these crowds away. No. Jesus, it's getting late. Don't you know I have to go to the gym in the morning? No. Jesus, I wanna go deeper with this group of people that already knows you, my close friends. I wanna prioritize this group of people. Please send these crowds away. They're using their boundaries, many of them with spiritual language attached to them, to look Jesus in the eyes and say, I will not do the exact situation that you have placed me in. But here's what you're failing to understand if you do that. That's many of us. Here's what you're failing to understand if you do that. Jesus is always, on purpose, trying to push me past the limits of what I think I'm emotionally capable of, because that actually forces me to depend on him. Jesus is, this is not like some like subtle theme in the Bible. This is like the main theme. Jesus is always, on purpose, trying to push me past the limits of what I think I'm emotionally capable of, because that forces me to actually trust him, to actually believe that he'll come through for me. Listen. I mean this in all the gentleness in the world, but if you never let him do that, which many of us, you won't let him do that. If you never let him do that, you will always have the emotional capacity of a child. There are many people in this room, I'm not trying to be mean, but you're in your 30s, but emotionally you're at the level of a 16-year-old. Because anytime God tries to challenge you or move you into something greater, you say, I know what's best for me. And if that's you, here's what you've forgotten. You have forgotten that Jesus will never ask you to do something that he won't do with you. I'm not gonna spoil the story, but when Jesus looks at his disciples and says, you feed them, they do end up feeding him, but who really feeds them? You have forgotten that Jesus is trying to draw you closer to him. He loves you so much. He knows who you actually are. He knows how to draw out the best parts of you. And that's what he's trying to do. But check me on this. A person who is loaded up on boundaries is actually a person who does not believe Jesus is actually with them. A person who's loaded up, who's guarded, is a person who actually does not trust God. Which leads me to the third symptom that your faith has become useless, that the bridge of hope has collapsed. The third symptom is this: cynicism. Cynicism. Let me continue with the story for a second. John 6, verse 8. Then Andrew, another one of Jesus' disciples, Peter's brother, spoke up and said, hey, Jesus, there's this young boy here with 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what good is that with such a huge crowd? Somewhere along the way, there was like a little kid that had like a lunchbox, and he had like 5 pieces of bread and 2 fish in it. And he comes up to Jesus and is like, Jesus, can you use my lunch? Lightning McQueen lunchbox, whole thing. Jesus, will you use my lunch to feed 20,000 people? And Andrew meets this kid. He sees that kid and he's like, that's cute, kid. Like, that's just like not helpful. Like, you know, we're looking for like restaurants. That's what we're trying to do. And so he brings the kid to Jesus, and Andrew says, but what good is that? The problem is too dire. But what good is that? The need is too great. Let me define the word cynical for you. Cynicism just means to draw attention to the negative. Cynicism just means to prioritize the negative over the positive, to have a natural dispropensity propensity to point out what's wrong with something. And I'm pretty passionate about this, because for years of my life, this plagued my relationship with God. It ruined my relationship with God. For years of my life, I never wanted to be swept up in something that was false. And I never wanted to be caught believing something that wasn't true. And I never wanted to be emotionally manipulated in any kind of a way. So what I would do is I would walk into every situation and I would just analyze it. And I would be critical and point out the flaws in everything. And I would question everyone's intentions and be skeptical of everyone's motives. And some of you, maybe you've been a Christian for a long time. I'm gonna talk to Christians for a second. Maybe this is you. Let me give you like a little cynicism quiz if you've been around Jesus for a little bit. Have you ever heard someone say a prayer and thought to yourself, psh, that's not gonna happen. Nice try, kid. That's not gonna happen. Do you walk into church and do you pick things apart? That point was too shallow. I wouldn't have said that. That wasn't deep enough for me. That song, I only like the slow, sad songs because those are the deeper ones. Those are the only ones that I know how to connect to God with, which is, I don't even get me started on it. Have you ever seen like a new follower of Jesus and you go, that new follower of Jesus, oh, they're so cringy. Oh man, they wear like Jesus t-shirts and they post stuff on Instagram and they listen to Forrest Frank. You know what I mean? Like, man, that's so cringy. By the way, can we just all get on the same page? Any person that's always pointing out that person's cringe, you're probably the cringe one. I just would like to get on the same page about that. Have you ever seen someone who was sincere, but you question their motives and you're like, I don't buy it. So maybe you saw someone's baptism and you're like, I don't think they really understand the gospel. I think they're doing this for the wrong reason. I think they're doing this for attention. Here's a big one for me. Do you constantly like talking about how dark the world is and how hard your life is way more than you like talking about how good God is to you and how much he loves you? I was a guy for a long time, bro. If we started talking about the love of God too much and the goodness of God too much, I would like roll my eyes and be like, well, you can't forget about terrorism. For years of my life, I had a martyr complex. I really did. I walk around, oh, it's so hard to follow Jesus in this culture of America. I didn't get invited to a party one time. I make 30% less money than my friends. Oh, it's so hard. Like this, I had a martyr complex, and that's many of you. You love talking about how dark the world is, how shallow other people are, how hard your life is. That's many of you. And for the longest time, I thought the reason I was like that was because I was mature and because I was beyond childish things. But then I started reading the teachings of Jesus for myself. And he talks about this over and over again, by the way. And God convicted me and taught me the reason I was like that was not because I was mature. The reason I was like that was because I was a coward. It takes remarkable courage to have childlike wonder and childlike faith in a horrible circumstance. And you might be like, Josiah, you don't know how dark the world is. Bro, do you know what my job is? Like, seriously, like I'm the one that meets with like pedophiles and sex offenders and tries to lead them to Jesus. That's my job. I don't know how many suicide calls you get on the regular. I get a lot. I know how dark the world is. And it takes courage to stand in the middle of that darkness and say, but I still believe God can do a remarkable outcome. Here's what I've learned. As long as you choose to see the world through the lenses of the cynical, you will black out the kingdom of God. In your attempt to be smart, you've made yourself stupid. Quite honestly, man, like that means this Christian with their arms crossed, you are always the least mature person in the room. The Christian that's got to get up and leave before the music starts because you got places to be and I got here, I already learned the content. You're the least mature person in the room. And Jesus talks about this over and over again. Matthew chapter 11, here's one quote. Jesus says, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, thank you for hiding the truths. From the people who think of themselves wise and clever, who think they're mature, who think they've made it, and instead you revealed them to the childlike. If you're the kind of person who's guarded, here's the pros of being guarded. Seriously, here's the pros of being guarded. If you're guarded and skeptical and analytical, you will very rarely get caught up in anything that's false. That's true, other than the premise of being guarded is false. But other than that, you will very rarely get caught up in anything false. But here's the con of being guarded. You will never get swept up in anything that's good. And you'll never be a part of anything that's beautiful. You'll never be used by God. You'll just have a lot of opinions about other people that God actually does use. You will never experience the power of God. You'll just study it. C.S. Lewis, he has this great quote. This is one of my all-time favorite quotes. He says this. He's a professor. He's like the smartest of the smartest, bro. He made it. And he says this. To be concerned about being grown up, to admire the grown up because it is grown up, and to blush at the suspicion of being childish, those are the marks of childhood and adolescence. When I became a man, I put away childish things, including the fear of being childish and the desire to be very grown up. You hear what he's saying? He's saying the least mature thing, the most immature thing you could ever do is try and be mature. And the most mature thing you can ever do is embrace childlike wonder for the rest of your life, which leads me to the fourth symptom that the bridge of hope has collapsed, that you and God are not on the same page. Here's the fourth symptom: compartmentalizing God's power in your life. compartmentalizing God's power in your life. Here's what I mean by this. Many of us have subconsciously decided that there's certain areas of my life where God can work and do wonders, but not my relationship with my sister. Oh man, God's leading all these people to Christ all around the world. It's so incredible. Not my coworkers though. They're hard-hearted, whatever. God's helping all these people with their struggle, but not my struggle. You don't understand how different I am, how hard it is for me. The person that challenged me on this is one of my best friends in the world. One of my best friends in the world, he's one of the godliest people I know. He's the guy I call up for advice all the time. He's the guy I look to and be like, dude, how are you following Jesus? And we've been friends since we were 10. And when he was 10 years old, he was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And he would never let you know this, you know, years and years later, but that diabetes has plagued his life and caused him all sorts of pain that he never talks about. From unexpected seizures to always just needing to check his blood sugar and like all the, like anywhere we go, anything we're doing, there's this looming thing in the back of his mind that he has to take care of that's draining him, that's causing him, you know, all sorts of turbulence. And so last year, we were traveling and we were in the car and we just got talking about what God's doing in our life. And he told me something fascinating. He said, you know, Josiah, this past year, I've really been thinking about the power of God. And I've really been asking myself, do I actually believe that the Jesus who like walked on water and could do all, you know, heal the sick, all this, do I actually believe in that Jesus? Is that the Jesus that I believe in? And he said, when I was thinking about that, I realized I have never in my life ask God to heal me of my diabetes. I never even asked him. He goes, I just assume that like there's other people that have worse things than me. God would prioritize that. I just assume like maybe this is just like a condition. It just kind of is what it is. Like this is like my burden to bear. I've never even invited him into that area of my life. And so he said, I decided a couple months ago that I was gonna do it, full faith and believe that God would heal me. And so the Bible says, if you're sick, call up the pastors and elders of your church, have them pray over you. And so he's like, I called up my pastor and said, hey, will you round everybody up? I want to ask God to heal me of this. And so they did. And he went so far, he's like, I didn't refill my insulin. Like I'm going to show up to that meeting as if it's gone after that. I'm gonna just live as if that's true. And so he shows up to that meeting, the pastors pray over him. It's emotional, it's like this incredible time. He said, I felt so close to God. Like that was just one of the, I will never forget that day. That was just one of the most powerful days of my life. He said, I went home feeling great, just thankful to God, close to God like never before. And he goes, and then the next day, I'm feeling great in the morning, but as the day went on, my blood sugar started to get low and I realized that I still had diabetes. Now, if you're cynical and I'm telling this story, you're probably asking, okay, Josiah, like what's the point of this story? You know, this feels like a circular story. Well, here's the point of the story. My friend looked at me and said, Josiah, I know that sounds like a sad story, but it's not. Because here's what happened. My relationship with Jesus is in a place it has never been in my entire life. And I've known him for a long time. He like hit a whole new level of happiness, thankfulness, closeness. I can vouch for this. He's like, me and Jesus are close unlike ever before, because he said, I finally believe that God has the power to heal me and he's chosen not to, but I believe he can do it. And he's just given me this to bring honor to him. And then he said, I finally believe that God loves this part of me. That this is not like some siloed area of my life that I have to handle on my own. That God loves all of me. And my relationship with Jesus is far more important to me than any particular outcome. Here's the point. What if God is trying to heal your heart more than your circumstance? Now, don't catch me wrong. I'm not trying to scapegoat this thing. If you ask God to do something, God might very well do it. I mean, God can, you walk right out of a wheelchair. I believe that wholeheartedly. I'm not being superstitious, nothing like that. If you ask, God very well could do that. But what if God has a greater priority even beyond that? What if the thing that needs to heal more than your circumstance is your view of him? Because if you are compartmentalizing God out of any area of your life, that means you don't believe God has power over that part of your life. And that means you don't believe God loves you in that area of your life. And what if that's the thing that God has gone after the most? I just want you to think about this, bro. Think about this story, bro. I just want you to think about this little kid. In front of 20,000 people, Rocket Mortgage Arena, he's got his Lightning McQueen lunchbox, 5 pieces of bread, 2 fish, comes up to Jesus and says, Jesus, I think you can use this and feed everyone. I just want you to think about the social risk of that. the courage that that took. Think about how many, 20,000 people, how many people were laughing at him, making side comments to the person next to them about how cute it was? Let's be honest. Think about how many people in this room, and you claim to be a Christian, and you would have been the person laughing at him and making snarky comments. But what did this kid do? This kid proved that he was the only person in 20,000 people who actually believed in God. Everyone's looking at Jesus face to face, and he's the only person that believes, Jesus, I believe you can do exactly what you said you can do. And what happens? Let's finish this story. Verse 8, Andrew spoke up. There's a young boy here with five loaves and two fish. What good is that in this crowd? Whatever, kid. But Jesus says, no, hold up, Andrew. Tell everybody to sit down. So all the people, 20,000 people, sat on grassy slopes, the men alone, number 5,000. Jesus took the loaves and he gave thanks to God. And he distributed the loaves to all the people. Afterwards, he did the same with the fish, and they all ate, 20,000 people ate as much as they wanted. This is one of the most remarkable miracles in the Bible. Somehow, in some way, Jesus started breaking off the bread and just kept breaking it and breaking it and breaking it. And he takes the fish, same thing, breaking it, breaking it, breaking it. And everybody ate, not like a bite or two, everybody ate as much as they wanted. He multiplies the food. But here's the kicker for me. Here's the funny part of the story to me. After everyone was full, which is hilarious, after everyone was stuffed, Jesus told his disciples, now gather the leftovers so that nothing's wasted. So the disciples picked up the pieces and filled 12 baskets with scraps, leftovers, that had been left by the people who had been eaten from the five barley loaves. 12 baskets full of leftover food. Okay, why 12 baskets? How many disciples did Jesus have? How many people believed there's nothing we can do in this situation? How many people said, Jesus, don't ask me beyond my limits. Jesus, you don't understand my boundaries. Jesus, you, how many people? 12. Man, that must have stung. When you're like holding leftovers. But this gets to the point, the core. Why is it that it's so hard to have hope? Why is it that most of you tomorrow, you're gonna go to work or home or whatever it is, and you're gonna live the same exact day that would have happened if this message never happened before? Why is that? What is that? I'll tell you why. And if you listen to this last part, it'll change everything. I'll tell you why. The very core of a lack of hope is a fear of disappointment. All of us are afraid that if I give myself to something and that something lets me down again, I don't know what I'm gonna do with myself. And I get it, bro. Listen, I know for many of us in this room, your dad was your hero and he left. Or when you were in college, you met the person that finally understood you. You guys were gonna be together forever. Finally, I have a person that's with me and they're not here right now. And so what do? When we experience stuff like that, you decided, and very smartly so, I decided I will never make myself vulnerable to anyone like that again. I will never put myself in a position to experience that level of disappointment ever again. And I get that. I can't even tell you how much I get that. But everybody listen to me. Everybody listen to me. I need you to hold on to this. Jesus Christ will never fail you the way that everyone else has. And I'm not stupid. I know that me saying that and putting that on a slide is not gonna change your heart at all. I understand that, but I need you to listen. Jesus Christ is not your dad. Jesus is not your friend that betrayed you. Jesus is not your ex. Jesus is not your company. Jesus is not your health. Jesus is not that church you used to go to. Jesus Christ is in a league of his own. And he said, I will literally die before I let any promise go unfulfilled. I will raise from the dead before I let any promise go unfulfilled. And I know it's terrifying. It's terrifying to take another risk. But if you don't take that risk one more time, just one more time, to the person that should have had your trust to begin with, if you don't make yourself vulnerable just one more time, I'm only saying one more time, then you'll never know what life can be. You'll never really know who you are. And you'll never really know what love actually is. You know, just a few months after this story takes place, Jesus puts his disciples through another test. And this test is far worse than the one with the bread and the fish. You gotta remember, Jesus' disciples, they quit their jobs to follow Jesus. I mean, they cashed out 401k, they had nothing. Jesus' disciples, they left their family, they left their friends behind. Their reputations became basically meaningless because they followed this like cult rabbi. I mean, they made themselves vulnerable for Jesus. They had nothing. Jesus was the only thing that they had. So you have to imagine, because they did not know this was coming, you have to imagine their absolute shock when Jesus, their indestructible miracle-working king, was arrested and killed and hung on a wooden stake in the ground. You have to imagine like the horror in their eyes when they saw the corpse of their leader, naked, dripping blood, weak, lifeless, hanging on a cross. And you have to imagine, because they have no idea what's gonna happen. You have to imagine what's going through their head. This was the person I finally trusted, someone again, and he let me down. Even God, even the Son of God failed me. I knew it. The darkness is stronger than the light. Evil always over. I knew it. All hope was lost. And for 3 days, those disciples had to sit in that test, that darkness, not seeing any possible outcome because the miracle worker, because the king was dead. And I know that right now, many of us in this room, you're sitting in a test that's pretty similar, where you can't see any way that this thing is gonna turn around. You know, some of you, you're on year 7 of marriage or 27 of marriage or 47, whatever it is. And your spouse is just going through it. I mean, going through it. And they're being a jerk to you. I mean, legitimately hurtful, undeserved pain. And so you're standing here in the midst of this, in the midst of this circumstance, and here's the test. Can I still treat them with the love that Jesus showed me when I was at my worst, the worst of the worst? Even though I don't see this person getting better, I don't see this circumstance turning around, that's a test. Some of you are single and you didn't think you were gonna be single this long. You know, and so you're standing, and here's the test. Can I still believe that Jesus is actually the only love I need? Because it's really cute to say that when you're 18, but every 18-year-old still thinks that they're gonna get married. So can I actually believe, or am I gonna start compromising sexually? Are you gonna re-download all your dating apps? Are you gonna keep dating that loser that you met on Facebook? Like, that's a test. You're all chuckling, that's real. Some of you're working in a job right now and you're like, I have no idea that I'm made for so much more. This job is so pointless. I don't see how this corresponds to my path whatsoever. I don't see it. Okay, that's a test, because here's the test. Are you still gonna give your best and honor God in that? Are you still going to try and lead every person in that company to Christ, which is more important than giving your best, by the way, but you gotta do both? That's a test. Some of you are depressed. And the question is, am I gonna cling to the Bible, or is all that time going to YouTube? So some of you are really going through it. And someone you love just got a horrible diagnosis and you know it's awful. And your question right now, God, how could you be loving and let this innocent person go through this pain? And the test right now is, can you still believe that God is loving, compassionate, sees you, cares about them, even though nothing in your circumstance seems to be indicating that that is the truth? That is a test. And for 3 days, Jesus' disciples sat in that test, not seeing a way out. And for many of you, it's been 3 days or 3 weeks or 3 months or 3 years or 3 decades. But then, the most unexpected thing happened. The thing that none of the disciples even thought was remotely a possibility. 3 days later, the ground starts to shake. The stone in front of Jesus' body gets rolled. And the disciples are all sitting, having dinner together, wallowing in their sorrows, afraid of what's gonna happen next. And out of nowhere, Jesus just like walks into the room. And with kindness in his eyes and compassion on his face, Jesus looks at them and says, I told you I would never leave you. I told you I would never fail you. I told you I love you so much. I will do anything for you. I told you I would work all things out for your good. And listen, I don't know what you're going through. I don't know what you're going through, but I do know this. If you trust in Jesus and if you hold to him, at some point in your life, it could be in the next few years, it could be on the next side of heaven, I don't know. But at some point in your life, you're gonna be sitting there and Jesus is gonna walk in and you're gonna see him eye to eye and he's gonna have compassion in his eyes and he's gonna say, I told you. I told you I work all things out. I told you I was never going to leave you hanging. And the reason I know that is because if Jesus could overcome his own death, I'm pretty sure he can overcome everything else. Listen, if Jesus actually came back from the dead for me, I need to expect that same power in every area of my life. If Jesus actually came back from the dead for me, I need to expect that same power in every area of my life. And by the way, if I don't expect it, I don't know that I actually believe he came back from the dead. But I wanna ask you two questions, and I really want you to answer these questions like sincerely for yourself and your own life. Here's question number one. Is there any area of your life where you are living like you have no hope? Is there any area of your life where you are acting like the outcome is set, where you're just like, I guess I just have to power through this and survive this? Is there any area of your life where you are living like the power of God can't affect that, can't change that, can't do anything about it? I didn't say you have to get rid of all your emotions. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying, is there any area where you're living like there is no hope? Which leads to the second question. This is the bigger one. Are you willing to bridge the gap? Because this is a choice. Are you willing to bridge the gap between your current situation and what's true about Jesus? Are you willing to hope again, trust again, make yourself vulnerable again, and live with a childlike faith that my Father in heaven, my dad, he's gonna come through for me no matter what, even if no one else has. Here's where I wanna end. Here's how a lot of people are. And a lot of people's lives go, and I'll be honest, here's how most of your lives are currently going. It goes something like this. You're born with a lot of hope and a lot of optimism, and as you age and as you get older, all your dreams and ambitions slowly die a painful death. And so you get more snarky, and you're more afraid to take risks. A lot of you, you're midlife, and so you're very risk resistant. And you're like, I know how the world works. And so your hopes and your dreams and your optimism and your willingness to look foolish and stupid just goes down and down and down, and you get critical and, you know, whatever it is. And that's probably the vast majority of us in this room. And here's what's gonna happen. If that's you, one day you're gonna die. And if you're a Christian, you're gonna go to heaven. And when you get to heaven, what you're gonna do is you're gonna look around, and here's the thought you're gonna have. I was wrong, I was wrong. I was wrong. I thought there was no hope for this person whatsoever, so I never even reached out. And here they are in heaven right now. This person over here, Jesus just put a crown on this person's head and says, this person gets it. This person is the greatest in the kingdom of God. I used to make fun of that person and tell them that they were cringy and that they were shallow and that they were naive. This situation, I never thought that situation could work out for good. And yet, look at all these people in heaven because of that. Right, there are hundreds of people, thousands of people, maybe hundreds of thousands of people that are here in heaven right now because of a certain ministry or a certain church. And I used to criticize that church and sit on the sidelines and talk about how unhealthy mega churches are. You know what the problem is? And make all these excuses. And yet here's all these people that got rescued that were going to hell that are in heaven because of the thing I used to make fun of. I was wrong, I was wrong, I was wrong, I was wrong. And many of us are on that path right now. Here's how I want my life to go. And I'm dead set on this, bro. I'm dead set on this. Here's how I want my life to go. I want it to go like this. That over the course of my life, my hope, my trust, my risk goes up and up and up. Bro, when I'm 85 years old, I wanna have more childlike wonder than ever before. I wanna take bigger risks for God's kingdom than I ever have. I wanna look more stupid than I ever have. I wanna laugh more. I wanna sing louder, I wanna dance more. I wanna see Jesus do the most remarkable things in my life at the end of my life, because things keep increasing, increasing, increasing. When I'm 85 years old, I wanna be the little kid that says, here, Jesus, here's my lunchbox, change the world. And I'm far from that, I know I'm far from that. But I know that Jesus is working on my heart and I'm trusting him with that and he's a part of that journey. And by the way, I don't care how old you are, Jesus can do this in your life right now too. I don't know how long you got, But Jesus can do this in your heart too. And when I get to heaven, I want to look around and I want my thought to be, I was right, I was right, I was right, I was right. This person is here, furthest from God, stubborn, rebellious, and yet here they are leading the charge. This circumstance that I thought, God, I thought you were wasting 5 years of my life. And look at what you built with your kingdom because I was faithful in this. I was right. I knew it. I knew you would work it out for my good. I was right. 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 Because if Jesus actually came back from the dead for me, I need to expect that same power in every area of my life. So is there any area of your life that you are living like you have no hope? What is it? And then two, will you have the courage? Will you have the guts to reach out and start bridging the gap? And all you need to do, if you want to do that, if you want your heart to pivot, all you need to do is in these next few moments, pray to God and say, God, I'm sorry. I was wrong. I was stubborn. But will you change my heart and let me see things the way you do? Let me trust again. And God, if you mean it, God will honor that prayer every time. I'm gonna pray for us. The band's gonna settle in. I want you to spend time with God. Dear Jesus, Lord, I just pray that you would work in a remarkable way in this room right now. As sometimes I get, sometimes I get discouraged teaching that people are gonna be too stubborn to receive any of this. And I pray that you would help me with my hope. But Lord, I pray for any person here that does not know you, that in these next 10 minutes, you would use the truths of these songs, grab a hold of their heart, and that they would give their lives to you. God, I don't know who in this room has the most stubborn heart that would call themselves a Christian. I don't know who that person is. But whoever that person is, God, I pray in your name, Jesus Christ, that by the end of this service, they are the most giddy person in this room. Lord, change our hearts. Use us to change Akron, to change our country, to change the world. But let us do it all by anchoring our hope in you and who you are. We ask this in your name, Jesus Christ. Amen.